The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
All right, welcome to part two of the BS Report. If you missed part one, Cousins, Al, and I did our thing with the Week 10 NFL slate. Coming up a little bit later in part two, Dave Jacoby and I are going to try to defend The Walking Dead, which has become the most despised show on the internet. But now, our old friend, the Subway Fresh Take Hotline, Chris Connolly from ESPN and ABC. What's happening?
Bill, how are you?
I sent out the bat signal for you today because I totally forgot this, and I'm kicking myself because I usually pride myself on remembering dates, things that happened. And
sure.
All that stuff. November 7th, 1991, Magic Johnson announces he has HIV. 20-year anniversary of that. It's weird to call it the anniversary, but
yes.
In a way, you know, because the anniversaries are supposed to be celebratory, and it's weird to celebrate that somebody 20 years ago today announced he had HIV. On the other hand, it is a little bit celebratory because everybody thought Magic Johnson was going to be dead within 3 or 4 years, and 20 years later, he's still living. He's in, in complete control of everything he's doing. He's on TV. He's a very successful businessman. And, come back. Let's go back to that day. You were living in Los Angeles, right?
I was. I was in Hawaii when the announcement happened. I was on the set of Honeymoon in Vegas, in Kauai, with, I know this is on your Netflix queue, with Nick Cage and Sarah Jessica Parker and James Caan.
Yep.
Written, directed, and produced by Andy Bergman, who had done The Freshman, which I thought was one of the funniest movies ever made, and The In-Laws.
Yeah.
And was about to make Striptease with Demi Moore, you'll recall.
Mm. $20 million paycheck.
Pardon me?
$20 million paycheck for her.
I believe that's correct, yeah.
It was a big deal back in the day.
I actually would have said it was 12, but for whatever it was a groundbreaking amount of money. So there was plenty to talk about, and they were basketball fans. And then in the middle of our time there, all of a sudden this announcement came, and I can remember watching it. And like you were referring to, it's one of those events that you'll always remember where you were and what you were doing when you saw it. It just, you just thought, how bad can the news be? How much worse can news get than this?
Yeah.
And I think everybody, you know, everybody who was touched with that felt like that, you know. When I moved out here in 1990, I'm a New York sports fan. I still root for New York teams, but it wasn't like I didn't think about Vin Scully and Wayne Gretzky and the chance to see Magic Johnson. And so,
right.
You know, even though I hadn't been a fan of the Lakers, you certainly were, you know, everybody, no one could resist his magnetism. And then for something like that to happen, it felt like all of our lives would be dramatically different from that moment onward. And I don't think anyone could have predicted where we would be 20 years from now.
And also, like, just not educated at all about HIV versus AIDS. Like, he says he has the HIV virus, and I'm in college. I assume that means, oh, he's going to be dead now in a year. Like, you don't even know that, you know, the HIV virus is what eventually turns into AIDS if you don't treat it, or if you, you know, if you're not lucky with some of the medications or whatever. But just people in general, just didn't know a lot about it. And that, you know, had a lot to do with how it was covered, the disease, the lack of movies and TV shows with HIV-positive characters, things like that. And it was kind of this underground thing that was going on for a long time in a lot of ways. And, you know, I don't think the people under 25 years old, I don't think they realize, like, what a seminal moment this was, just from the disease going from this thing that was covered one way to now becoming a public thing that everybody knew about. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I was the receptionist at Rolling Stone in the early 80s, or for a year in the early 80s, and I remember a kind of performance artist vocalist named Klaus Nomi, who was kind of a club scene guy at the time, but who was sort of an underground musician of some repute, coming by every now and then and dropping things off. And I think he is the first well-known individual ever to have died from AIDS. And so if you were, certainly if you were covering entertainment and music, you know, its scourge was a big topic of conversation. But in terms of sports, certainly in terms of a mainstream figure, it was brand new news, and it was shocking to contemplate the possible reverberations that came from Magic Johnson's announcement.
And a big part of it was it was a disease that was just considered a gay disease.
Yeah.
And when he got it, the first reaction was, well, that's impossible. He's married, you know. And then the second wave of that was, well, he's gay and he's not telling us. And that became this undercurrent that led to, which I've written about, when he went on Arsenio's show that time and he announced that he was not gay and the crowd applauded. And, you know, that was probably the most unseemly part of this whole thing, I feel like, looking back.
Perhaps we can look back with a forgiving eye. A lot of things were said by people who should have known better, things that were said out of fear or ignorance or some sort of hatred, you know, that were really regrettable and that you know, I think in a lot of cases people regret having said or done at that time. It just really threw people. And I think, you know, the time would come that pretty much everyone's life would be touched, you know, by people with HIV or losing friends or relatives, you know, to this disease. And so a lot of the stigma that sort of had attached itself to that disease prior to Magic Johnson's announcement tended to go away, I think.
Well, and, you know, if you look at, like, what was going on in the early mid-80s, AIDS didn't even really have a name. What was it, until 1985?
Yeah, I remember the first time that Rolling Stone wrote about it, the original name was GRID, G-R-I-D, again,
gay,
it's capital letters.
Gay-related immune deficiency, right? That
yeah.
was the acronym.
And then when, yeah. I remember when Rolling Stone wrote about it for the first time, the cover head, you know, the line that appears on the cover was, you know, terminal sexual cancer is how it was described. So yeah, a lot of, you know, we had a lot to learn
Well, even before that, wasn't it? It was called the gay plague before the.
Well, in a kind of informal way. I think a writer named David Black did a big, two-parter, I think, for Rolling Stone too. You know, where he called it like a journal of the plague years. But yeah, the idea that it was only going to affect one particular slice of the community was a misnomer, and everybody learned otherwise.
Well,
I remember, yeah, the other guy who was kind of in that special group of Los Angeles sports figures was Jim Murray, the columnist, who was still writing, I think, in the early 90s out here. And if you came out here and you came from New York or something, Jim Murray out here was like a combination, in the way he was held in estimation. Jim Murray was like a combination of Red Smith, Mike Lupica, Dick Young. I mean, he like rolled it all up. You take your three favorite columnists from Boston, put them all together, and that's the way Jim Murray was regarded out here.
Yeah.
And when Magic Johnson gave his announcement, I remember the columns were just stunned. I think Plaschke or somebody like him just wrote a column where he was just stunned. And the line that Plaschke, I think, kept using was, he was smiling when he said this news. He it was just stunning. And I'm pretty sure it was Murray, of all people, you know, Murray who'd lived through so much, Murray who said at the end of his column, if he beats this, I want to see that smile. And how about it that 20 years later, we get to see that smile, just as Jim Murray alone was able to predict.
And nobody even talks about it with Magic. I mean, I'm sure, like, in a lot of ways, I wonder how he feels about this day. I haven't read anything that he's said about today. I don't know if anybody's interviewing him or whatever. But for the most part, at this point, he's tried to live his life without making this part, you know, one of the things that people talk about when they talk about him, and he's pretty much succeeded.
Well, what a spectacular life, as you just outlined.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like if all he had done were to be the symbol of surmounting this disease, or a symbol of the way science was able to come up with ways, science and you know, a hardy group of activists were able to spur, you know, research and progress in terms of treating this disease. If all he was, you know, those covers of the news magazines when those new drugs came out, where, you know, where he was like dressed as Superman, and they said it's not just magic.
Yeah.
If that was all he had done, that would be awesome. But he's lived this incredible, full, spectacular life along the way, you know.
Yeah.
About six months or maybe 9 months after his announcement, we were over here in the neighborhood in Los Angeles in which we live, and we came upon the Lakers playing softball. The Lakers were just sort of out there playing softball, and so Jerry West was there and a bunch of other guys on the team, and our son was maybe like 4 or 5 years old at the time, and Magic was up at bat. He was batting, and Henry ran all the way to the softball backstop and took a look and ran back and yelled, "Magic is batting, and he looks really good."
And he's never really, I mean, when we think about what we expected would happen, like if anything,
yeah,
he gained weight, and I know he gained weight from the cocktails and stuff like that, but I think I remember just the day and the week that it happened, we just assumed that we were just going to watch this guy slowly waste away and die.
Do you remember Larry Bird's reaction?
Vaguely, what was it? I can't remember.
I hope I don't have this wrong, and I didn't check this before we talked, but didn't he say something like, there's only one time or so in my life that I've cried until now?
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah.
That was when my dad took his own life, you know?
Yeah.
And that's essentially how I feel today, you know?
Yeah.
Count on him for the right response in the right moment, when not everybody was talking that way, you know? The other thing I remember is when he played in the All-Star game.
Yeah,
was that later that year or like a few months afterwards?
February.
When they had him play in the All-Star game?
Yeah, it was probably 4 months later.
I was coming back from the Miami Film Festival, and boy, don't you wish you'd been there.
I do.
And I was just going to miss the game. I knew I had to watch the game in my office because I'd never make it home in time for the game. And so I got off the plane. I ran to the office. And I remember just sitting in the only person's office at Premier Magazine who had a television and watching him being introduced. And I was a mess. I was a mess. And then he hits that shot with like 90 seconds to go, and they just call the game.
Yeah.
Comes out and swarms him. Oh my God, I was a mess watching that. So
yeah, it was weird because, you know, I do think the players were, I had written this, the players were kind of terrified to go near him to some degree, and he was able to do whatever he wants. But at the same time, it was pretty neat that, you know, he was out there, this guy that we were all writing off 4 months ago, and he was, you know, kind of still had it to some degree. It's just a really weird time in general. You know, you were so immersed in the movie music scene at that point. What was like the fear of HIV like in 1990, 1991? What was your,
it had gone back earlier than that. You know, it was like, you know, the whole Rock Hudson thing had been a big deal because Rock Hudson had been on Dynasty, I guess, and he had a kissing scene with Linda Evans, you know.
He had a few of them, yeah.
You know, just the level of ignorance and fear, you know, in that era, and the scapegoating of gay people or gay lifestyle or something like that. You know, there was a lot of regrettable behavior on everybody's part and things that were said that were regrettable. I think for the entertainment industry, by the time Magic, you know, announcement came out, it was like, well, you see now what it's been like, you know. The last 7 years, it's like sports world, welcome to the, you know, welcome from out from under your, you know, your ignorance. You know, here we go. You thought it was just going to be, you know, gay people, actors on Broadway, actors in movies and stuff. Well, here you go. You know, welcome to our world. So, in a sense, I think it was. I think that was kind of the, you know, that was kind of the feel. And now 20 years later, you look back and you think, you know, just his life, just his attitude, just his joyfulness, you know, his joyfulness and his intelligence throughout it all, you know, really, really has made a real difference. You know, yeah. Just the model of his life and the way he's lived it has been just an incredible message for people. And we're very blessed that he handled this terrible news in the way he did and that he's thrived as he has.
All right, tough question, but I'm going to ask it. Let's say Magic doesn't get HIV in 1991. How does our whole experience as a country and as a world with HIV go from 1991 on if we don't have that one guy who gets it, who kind of gets everything in motion? What happens?
Well, I can't tell you that my history is perfect in this regard. You know, certainly there are other, you know, there are other athletes or personalities that caught people, whose names might have caught people by surprise in terms of how they were, in terms of something like this, whether it was Eazy-E or, Isaac Asimov or some of the blood transfusion people, you know,
so you're saying Eazy-E might have been a bigger deal.
Well, it was.
I gotta find out when he died.
We all remember reading the obituaries where people were referred to as having died from complications of pneumonia.
Right.
You know, and then you had to do the math and stuff. I mean, it's just horrible that people would be ashamed of. People would feel as though they had to be ashamed of dying from a disease. But we all, you know, we all heard all the, you know, there were euphemisms pressed on people. There were ways in which things had to be discussed so it didn't upset family. I mean, there was all that stuff going on. Without Magic, I don't think we would have had that kind of, we wouldn't have had that star in the sky with the big smile kind of seeing us through. So I don't know how it would have gone. I think the ignorance would likely have continued for a good period of time, because the other athletes that you think of who are connected with HIV tended to be marginal athletes, not superstars. I'm just
right.
Going to look up something now and see if I'm right or not.
Well, Eazy-E died in 1995.
Uh-huh.
Tommy Morrison got HIV in 1996.
Right.
I'm trying to think who else. I'm looking
there
at
is, there is one other person, and I'm just checking.
Oh, Freddie Mercury.
Hmm?
Freddie Mercury.
You know, but the one, you know what I was going to say was Greg Louganis.
Oh.
Because Louganis won a gold medal in front of all of us, and Louganis was tough.
And had the Louganis
hit his head on the dive.
Yeah.
Louganis hit his head on the diving platform while he was in the Olympics. I mean, cracked his head on the diving platform while he was in the Olympics and still won the gold medal, you know? The connection that people didn't make was how tough and strong people who dealt with this kind of thing were. You know, there was that persistent stereotype of the effeminate gay man who couldn't handle difficult things. When in fact what was going on was that gay people were proving to be the most resourceful and toughest, you know, community on the planet. You know,
yeah.
Really smart, really aggressive, really brave, dealing with this sort of stuff. And so I think Louganis would have been the transitional figure that way, just because he was great looking, he expressed himself really well, you know, did this diving thing, which was, you know, kind of elegant and stuff, but had shown he was a tough guy, like really a tough guy. So maybe he might have been the transitional figure. I don't know.
And even he was, I just looked it up, he wrote the book in 96 when he came out as having HIV,
yeah.
But it might have done it a year earlier, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, really, you can't underestimate the stigma, you know, all those sort of things, you know.
Yeah.
You know, sport's not always the most socially forward community, as we know. So, certainly it was a tough situation for anybody to have to talk about that kind of stuff in those contexts.
Well, even now, like you look back and like Karl Malone, when Magic was thinking of coming back and Karl Malone said he didn't want to play against him and a bunch of other people came out and said that. And, you know, it looks horrible now when you look back. You're like, wow, what an a-hole Karl Malone was that he said that. But, you know, it was just a different time. And I think the fear levels were just much higher. And that leads to a little bit of irrationality and just uneducated people about the disease who, you know, I never really totally blame those people for thinking that way. It was wrong.
No, I mean, you know, those were regrettable remarks, but it's not like he was the only person who thought that.
Right. It was a
lot
of
people. He articulated a feeling that certainly a lot of those guys must have had. And so as regrettable as those words were, it was better for them to be out in the open so people could, you know, people could deal with them. So
don't you think, this is, you know, I thought And the Band Played On was, I thought, one of the better books just from just learning about something that you didn't know anything about, at least for me. I thought that was a great book. And I really liked the TV movie, too, which I think we've even talked about. It's one of my favorite
on
TV
HBO,
movies.
Yeah, Randy Schultz, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Matthew Modine's, I think, his last great role is the CIA.
Well, if you don't count Cutthroat Island.
Oh, yeah, I forget about that. A lot of cameos in that, but that's a great movie. And you think about it, like, the entertainment industry, all the stuff that they've done HIV-related has really, other than Philadelphia with Tom Hanks, which, you know, we didn't even talk about, that was another seminal moment, I feel like.
Yeah, it was. And again, like, you think, oh, okay, so he played, you know, you look back in history and you think, oh, that's like, you know, that's like the guy with polio in some movie. You don't realize, like, what a big, fat deal that was at the time.
And it's a really kind of, it's a really dated movie, put it that way.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. It's like it was made with the best intentions by the nicest people, and I'm sure there are little moments where you pull back a little. But it mattered at the time. It really did. So
it was really important, and it was like a big risk for Tom Hanks.
Oh, yeah, and Jonathan Demme and, you know, and Jason Robards with those, you know, those scurrilous things he had to say and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah, they had that, you brought AIDS into our law office.
Yeah,
of, like, a couple evil scenes. But, you know, that it played into everything else that was going on. It's a... Basically, the overriding theme of that movie is gay people are people too, which now is not a movie. That wouldn't be the theme of your movie in 2011. But
It was a little like the movies of the and I loved these movies. Don't get me wrong. It was a little like the movies of the late 50s and early 60s, where African Americans, you know, showed that they would deserve to be treated equally by being much, much, much better than anyone else in the movie.
Yep.
You know, by being so far morally superior to people, they deserve to be treated equally, which in its way is whatever the racial equivalent of paternalism would be, I suppose. It's a kind of condescension in a way, well-intentioned though it is. It's like nobody has to be better than anybody else to get to be deserved treated equally, so...
Philadelphia had that Halloween scene when Hanks is dancing with Antonio Banderas.
Mm-hmm.
Denzel Washington dancing with his wife, and Denzel looks over and they kind of make eye contact, and it's like, see, Tom Hanks can dance with the person he loves too. It's okay.
There you go.
Yeah, so like a lot of those scenes, it was like like in 2011. It's actually kind of a funny rewatch in a lot of ways because it's just it's so careful about taking every footstep that it takes, and now.
Yeah, it was a very decent film, and again we kind of roll our eyes and go wow, but for the era it sort of had to be done. Maybe it's time for you to write the career reappreciation of Antonio Banderas.
He's the next career arc after he outdid
Eddie Murphy at the box office last weekend.
It might be time.
All my wife wants is for a GPS system that's narrated by Antonio Banderas.
And why that? You should always be able to pick different celebrity voices for your GPS.
Take a, but, how you say, left.
It's a great
We'd never get out of the car.
Well, when you think about it, if they have voice-activated, like, college football video games and Madden and all that, and you have Aaron Andrews, like, doing sideline reports, we should be able to have Antonio Banderas do our
Yeah, who would you like? I mean, if you were driving the car by yourself, what actor or actress would you like telling you where to go?
Oh, no question, it would be Sam Jackson. No question at all. I don't even know. Can you even ask me? I might have Sam do that anyway. I might have him drive around in my car with me and tell me where to go.
I know. But if all these guys, if like, you know, we would do a lot of FIFA around here. If, you know, if Martin Tyler can sit in a room and just say all these the soccer-related things that get used in the game over and over again, can't you just do the same thing with, you know, with Sam Jackson or Susan Sarandon or somebody like that?
Chris Connolly, it's a $1 billion idea you're sitting on right here.
I will, you know, I'll get right to it. You watch.
You know, another one, good one would be Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah, I mean,
he'd do
the money could all
Bruce
go to charity. It would, you know.
Yeah. He could do
there could be various references to worker-related landmarks as you drove by them.
Take
That's
a left over
got
here.
Together for the first time to stand up to the boss.
Take a left, and by the way, this factory is where a lot of people die fighting for their dreams. This is the river. Yeah, I'm in on Celebrity GPS. It's a billion-dollar idea. Just make sure you cut in Chris Connolly on part of this. Hey, had you done... Let's say ESPN called you yesterday and they're like 24 hours to work up a feature about Magic's HIV in 1991, that announcement and the ramifications. What angle do you take?
You know, where did we come in 20 years? How far along did we go, I think? You know, the difference between the terror and the anguish that we felt on that day and the feeling of, not that the AIDS crisis is over by any stretch, but the feeling of self-empowerment and hope and really inspiration that Magic brought to this whole thing that changed the way a lot of people felt about what this disease meant, you know, who it struck and what kind of life you could live after a diagnosis like that. You know, you really think of him, I think, as being like one of the twin stars of the movement in a way after 1990. You think of like him and Larry Kramer, the guy who wrote The Normal Heart, you know. Kramer, yeah. Totally different personality from Michael, you know, from Magic Johnson, just aggressive and angry and getting people to do things. But those are really the two strands that kind of define where we've been able to go, you know, thanks to that really aggressive, you know, group of activists who just pressed and pressed and pressed and pressed for better treatment and better research. And then Magic is the human face of, you know, what can happen when you don't lose belief, when you stay positive and when you live this richful life.
Yeah.
You know, the story, it's the opposite of one of my stories, Bill. It starts out really sad and gets happier.
Yeah, you don't like that. You like to flip that dynamic around.
I don't know. It would be like my version of Memento.
Yeah, you do Memento. That's good. That's how you do it. While I have you on the phone, I want to talk about Eddie Murphy quickly because he had his
fascinating. I really enjoyed seeing your reading your breakdown.
Thanks. I had fun writing it. It was long, but I left out a movie somehow. I left out Showtime with Robert De Niro.
Pity.
Somehow he got it. It was on the cutting room floor. Maybe with reason because nobody remembers it. But when your take on Eddie in terms of when you become that famous that soon, what is the ceiling after a certain point?
Well, it all depends on what you want to achieve. You know, the difference is what your ambitions are. Some people have gigantic ambitions and they fulfill them. Redford had gigantic ambitions. He made a whole bunch of successful movies. He created Sundance. Oprah had gigantic ambitions. She had a very successful show, and she created really, you know, an entire entertainment world around her. Not everybody has those big ambitions. You know, Madonna has those big ambitions. You know, a lot of it is about a kind of curiosity about the world, and that would be the one question mark you put next to Eddie. You talked about Best Defense. What a mess that was. Eddie didn't like being overseas. Eddie didn't like not being able to order a cheeseburger in Israel, you know. And as Eddie sort of says in that Rolling Stone interview, Eddie didn't want to use his juice to do something really different. He didn't want to play Jackie Robinson. He didn't want to be in August Wilson's Fences. He didn't want to use that power to get the Unmakeable project made. That just wasn't where his head was at, you know. And so if you don't have that going on, then it's hard not to repeat the things you've done before. You know, as you and I talked about before, it's like the thing that Eddie really liked to do was to dress up as other characters through that amazing makeup. Yep. That's the hinge point in his career, really, when he does Coming to America and he plays all those guys in the barbershop. It's tremendous, right?
Yep.
But four different characters in the barbershop. But that's the thing he said, yeah, I want to keep doing that, right?
Yep.
You know, I want to keep doing that kind of thing because that's amazing. And he kept doing that. He didn't really use his Hollywood authority to go so much in the directions that other guys at that time were doing. You know, remember, that's a period like late 80s or something. That's when you have Jodie Foster and Kevin Costner and, you know, and eventually Mel Gibson and people like that. Tom Hanks, guys using their presence in Hollywood to kind of get involved in other things and to stake those things out. And Eddie did direct a movie, and he directed it, I think, out of love for Richard Pryor more than anything else. But I don't think he had those levels of ambitions and didn't really connect with the kind of community that did have those ambitions. And I think that may have been where things went, you know, if you think that things went awry for him, that was where you'd say things went awry for him. Is that he didn't have the next thing he wanted to do. Not even like Jim Carrey. You know, he didn't even want to do The Truman Show or something like that. He didn't see the upside. Yeah, and you called him on this in your story. He didn't see the upside of trying the daring thing. I think he says in his interview, you try the daring thing, they just knock you down. But some guys did it and did some interesting work as a result. And you would have to say he didn't really do anything like that.
I thought that Rolling Stone interview, it was really the only reason I wrote that piece. I was so fascinated by the quotes for a couple of reasons. One, because he just hadn't given an interview in so long.
And he used to be so good at it. I mean, he used to be one of the best interview subjects around.
He was one of Letterman's best three or four guests, like, for an entire decade. But it really did seem like he was self-aware of everything that had happened to him. And if you really read between the lines with some of the quotes, like, on the one hand, he's claiming he doesn't care. That it's all about, you know, making money and making fun choices. These are the gravy years. But then at the same time, he had a lot of bitterness about some of those, you know, somehow some of those choices have been received. So it was like, well, what is it? So you don't care what people think, or you do? Because it sure seemed like he did care what people thought.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and there are those stories over the, I mean, there's a story, I don't know if it's true, that he left the Oscars after he didn't win Best Supporting Actor and that.
Yep.
You know, I don't know that that's true. That's just sort of the story. You know, the two things in his life that we don't really know about are, A, his domestic life. He did have a lot of kids. He references the fact that they're all doing really well, but he never let us in to see that stuff. And that would have added to our understanding about what kind of guy he is. And there were a lot of kind of business upheavals, you know, on the management side for him that could have altered the arc of his career. When I spent a week with him, I did a story with him for Rolling Stone during the last week he spent at Saturday Night Live.
Really?
Yeah. I hung out with him the whole week. It was a lot of fun.
So you were there that night when he shot the all the sketches for that last half of the season, basically?
So I just remember it was going to be his last week there, and the sketch I remember was a sketch with Joe Piscopo on a bench where they both got laughing so hard that you thought, like, it's a lot of fun. But the moment that I remember the most that perhaps you'll appreciate, Kool and the Gang was the musical guest that week.
Wow.
And we were in his dressing room rehearsing. And as you chronicle, he had Party All the Time about to come out, and he had ambitions to be a music star and all that. And Kool and the Gang are rehearsing doing, like, Joanne or something like that. And he turned to me and he points to the screen and said, "See, all I have to be is that good."
It's crazy. He, you know, it's one of those things, though, where it's, you're really good at something that soon, that you just start thinking, what else can I be good at? Maybe I can do this too. Maybe I can do this. And that's usually when people get into trouble.
Well, I mean, everybody has some ambition. I mean, everybody wants to do the next thing. It's like, I think the ones who really flourish, you know, get really involved in material or get involved in an idea and take it to another level and stuff. And that's what we saw with some of those other transitional figures at that period, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know that Eddie, you know, chose to sort of do it that way.
But think about Tom Hanks.
Right.
Because basically, you know, I do think there's some validity to you have about a 7-year run as a comedian in leading movies, and then you're going to have to throw some sort of curveball. Or you can do what Adam Sandler's doing and just churn out these movies that make money and aren't critically respected. But had Eddie at that point just said, you know what, I'm a really good actor. I'm going to start taking some dramatic chances. Like you pointed out earlier. I do think he could have gone that Tom Hanks route and had a totally different career as a real actor.
The thing is, and this I think, he had no interest in that.
No, zero.
He could have, you know, at Paramount, after all the money he made for them, he could have made a movie where he sits in a room and reads the, you know, reads the phone book, and they would have made it. And for whatever reason, he didn't want to make that movie, you know. Now, you know, it doesn't, you don't have to turn into the class nerd just because you have the opportunity, but he didn't, you know, didn't want to play Robert Johnson, he didn't want to do any of those things that could only have gotten made if Eddie Murphy was attached to it. And, you know, it's his prerogative, but that's, you do have to move forward in some way. You know, Hanks is the best example, as you have illustrated, of a guy who flipped the switch on his career and became a different sort of actor, and very successfully so. We'll never really know. Part of the, you know, there were, you would hear stories of Eddie, like, not showing up for shoots, or, you know, being late to the set one day, or, you know, and who knows if those were just bitter people or if any of those things were true. But, you know, he had the ability to, you know, to walk on to a set, and you had your script and all the rest of it, but he could electrify that script. He wasn't just reading the lines. Some of that stuff was coming to him in the moment, you know, and he was electrifying, as you chronicle, like in those movies. He was just unbelievable. I don't know if that stays with you constantly, if you can keep doing it for year upon year. When he had his 100-mile-an-hour fastball, he was untouchable.
When you hung out with him in 84, it seemed like, I mean, my perception, though, is just as being a gigantic fan of his, was that he was handling everything about what was happening with his life really well, and that he was very self-aware of everything. And he, you know, he'd joke about it in late night shows. I wrote, like, you know, he always joked about how people are always so concerned he was going to blow his money, or he was going to get into drugs, or all these things. Like, people really worried about him, and he could sense that. When do you think, at what point in his career, like late 80s maybe, do you think he just started to, that started to change a little bit?
I couldn't, you know, I wasn't probably around for that. I certainly remember he didn't have much respect for the show he was on, for SNL at that time. And when you talk about his not coming back, I don't know how important this is. But the interesting thing about Eddie is I don't think Eddie ever worked for Lorne Michaels.
No, you're right. He didn't.
Eddie worked for Gene Demanian, and he worked for Dick Ebersol. But I don't think he necessarily had a relationship with Lorne Michaels.
No.
And that could have had something to do with his not coming back and doing more SNL. But again, in those days, leaving your TV gig was a much more of they can't keep me here anymore thing than it would later become.
Yeah,
you know, there was less sentimentality attached. There was less sort of let's drop on by and do more than there is today. So he couldn't wait to get out of there.
Fame hits everybody differently. Because did you see the Pearl Jam documentary?
Not yet.
I thought that was, you know, it was a lot of stuff I already knew, but put in a way that made me think about it again. It was really well done, I felt like. It was probably 10 minutes too long, but all documentaries are. The most fascinating part to me, the first hour is just incredible, about how the band came to be and how Eddie slowly took control of the band, and how the aims of the band changed from we're going to make awesome songs to, no, no, we can't be too famous. Everybody will hate us if we become too famous. And it really like colored the decisions of the third and fourth albums. Eddie was terrified that they would become too mainstream, and he didn't want that because his philosophy was, if you're too mainstream, then nobody will like you. Which is really kind of an interesting way to think about it. So in a way, he like sabotaged the band with the songs they picked for the albums.
How much was he affected by the death of Kurt Cobain and the sense that the mantle had been placed on his shoulders, a mantle he didn't necessarily wish to shoulder?
It seemed like what bothered him the most was the Time magazine cover. When they were on the cover, that to him represented everything he never wanted. And I don't think him and Cobain decided not to be interviewed for that piece.
Mm-hmm.
And they put Eddie in the cover anyway. And to him, that was like, all these things were happening to him that he never wanted. He just wanted to make music. And like they said in the documentary, like, they had to fight him to put Better Man on, I think it was the third album, because he thought it was too commercial, which is translation for it's going to do too well. We can't have this on there. And they're like, no, it's got to be on there. That's a good song, Eddie.
I always wondered if maybe the fight with Ticketmaster had something to do with just, you know, I do not want to be the human face of this movement anymore, you know.
No, I mean, look at, what was it, SNL or, the Unplugged concert. He wrote pro-choice on his arm. Like, he was always trying to tick people off.
I had a conversation with him after this 9/11 telethon that I worked on. It was called a Tribute to Heroes, and a lot of people were involved. And I wound up talking to him afterwards, and the extent of our conversation, God bless him, was him just going, you know, I know who you are, but I've never seen any of your work on TV. I never watch TV. I don't really like the channels that you're on most of the time. And I'm like, that's cool. That's great. You just keep doing the thing you're doing. Doing great. I'm really sorry. I feel bad that I don't know any of your work. It's okay. You're doing the right thing. You keep not watching what I do.
Right. It's a great documentary. It's really fascinating. And, you know, I'm obviously a huge Pearl Jam fan, and I would have liked it anyway. But I'm so fascinated by just bands and how they stay together and what those factors are and how they come to be and who takes control and how the jealousies come up and the writing process of the music and then what fame does to them. You know, obviously it would be impossible to do a 30 for 30 type thing because you'd have to get the rights for everything. It would just be too expensive, and in the wrong hands it would be terrible. But I do feel like I could have watched that documentary about 20 other bands.
Well, you know the thing that's interesting? I mean, Pete Townsend said this. He said when you're in a band, you're joined to the people you know at 20 years old for the rest of your life.
Right.
Now think of all the people you were really close friends with at 20. Imagine that like your fate is inextricably tied to being with them now that you're in your 40s.
Yeah.
You know, now a bunch of guys you're going to like, you're still going to like, but there are going to be some guys you just think, I can't believe I still have to hang out with this guy.
And it's so random, too. Like, a lot of times it's like, you know, you see this in the Pearl Jam documentary, it's like, hey, we need a lead singer. Our lead singer overdosed. They, you know, they didn't record for 6 months. Their lead singer, Mother Low Bone, died. They had no lead singer. They start accepting tapes from people.
Wow.
So they get this Eddie tape. They like it. They listen to it. Everybody's in on them. They come to meet them. They write songs with them. 5 days later, they're playing alive on a stage. You know, that's how random some of these.
You
just never know.
That's how we all got our jobs. You know, you talk about Eddie. I will say this. What are the things you kind of look for? What will determine things? I don't think he was married yet to Lisa Figueroa, but he was. I think they were involved. They were dating, and I did wind up at Eddie's house at one point during that story, and the two things I remember, all white carpet everywhere and huge photos of Eddie on the walls.
Oh, no.
Do you have a big photo of you up on the wall there, Bill?
I do not. Do not have anything.
Mansion? Not even in the man cave, right? A huge, like floor-to-ceiling photo of Eddie in that, I think he was in that red, leather outfit that he wore for one of those comedies. So that's, I don't know if that's a warning sign, but that's a thing where you go, you probably can't live your life quite like this.
I was arguing with a friend of mine who loves Raw, who was upset that I didn't give Raw enough love.
Sure.
And he thought it was one of the best, you know, the best creative things anybody's done and the standard for all comedy films, stuff like that. And to me, it was just that to me was Eddie at the height of his stage, as I wrote, where he really was beginning to think that he was Black Elvis.
Right.
And Eddie was somebody who loved Elvis and totally idolized Elvis, did an impersonation of him. He did the whole Buckwheat Got Shot thing, was basically a pair, the Buckwheat, they had this other sketch where it's basically Buckwheat is Elvis, he shoots the TV. And, yeah.
I know, I still to this day say lemonade, a cool, refreshing drink every now and then.
Give us something you're working on to plug.
Oh, this is perfect. I'm going to make sure I have the time and date just accurate here, I hope. But, no, I've got I've on E60 coming up tomorrow, 7 p.m. Eastern. Big story on Randall Cunningham that I think thanks to Vin Canamello, my producer, and a bunch of guys at E60, I think came out really well. So
excellent.
Tuesday night. A lot about him you didn't know.
Tuesday night, 7 o'clock, ESPN, E60. They got a lot of. I was proud of Andy Tennant and those guys. They got a lot of traction for that Scott Hall piece. I mean, was like they got like a week long internet buzz for that. It was fantastic. But
they do good work over there. I always think of myself as like the Mr. Roper of E60.
Nice.
Yeah, they're all young and lively, and they bounce around the table, and they all have their iPods and their iPads and stuff. And I go in like I have a walker, you know, and I sit down with my gray hair and go, well, you know, back in the 70s, I remember, you know.
What's going on with you kids? Chris Connelly.
Turn that up.
Chris Connelly is always a pleasure. We will talk to you soon.
Thank you, Bill.
All right. And now, as promised, sitting in my office at the Grantland offices, right where LA Live is, Dave Jacoby.
What's going on, Bill?
The audio video czar of Grantland,
That's right.
You have a podcast on Grantland Network.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a reality TV column. You have a bad QB column. I don't know what's going on with you, but you're suddenly the most prolific employee at ESPN, I think.
Well, we've got a big video coming out later this week as well on Thursday.
You're plugging that. Oh, look at you.
Friends of Grantland will be very happy to see a young Bill Simmons. Let's just leave it at that.
Yes. There's a video I shot with a special guest that we will be showing on Thursday. Good plug. Way to integrate that into the podcast.
That's not why you called.
That's not why I called. Listen, it's been far too long since we talked. You've been busy. And because we're together all the time, for some reason, well, then we should have a reality pod every once in a while.
Yeah.
Although you're writing a lot of your reality thoughts in your thing, so we don't necessarily need the podcast much anymore. But you and I are the only two people who like The Walking Dead, apparently, of any IQ over 80. You explain to the audience why you love The Walking Dead, and then I'll chime in.
I love The Walking Dead because they kill zombies. Because they kill zombies in good ways, and it works out. You know what I mean? I'm sorry, someone just tried to come inside your office. Here's why I love The Walking Dead, Bill. Because there's gruesome violence in almost every segment. And I'm on board. And it's not just that I love The Walking Dead as much as I hate The Walking Dead backlash. Like, that's the more emotional response from me, is how much I hate people that don't like The Walking Dead.
Including our own pop culture critic, Andy Greenwald, who just... He does recaps. He's, in my opinion, one of the best, if not the best, recap guys.
Fantastic writer.
Hates The Walking Dead. And we almost feel like we have to represent for The Walking Dead on Grantland. It's all leading to us just tag-teaming Greenwald on a podcast and just killing him.
Yeah, and I just talked to Lane Brown. He said it's a boring show.
Lane Brown is our pop culture editor. Yeah, he's dismissive. All these internet people it's too smart. They're too – The Walking Dead.
They're overthinking it, Bill. It's not about human emotion. It's not about storylines. It's not about any of that stuff. Just kill some zombies. There's dead zombies every single week.
Yes.
Like, what else is there to complain about?
I think what people seem to think, like, the show means something more than it does. Like, it's some sort of – well, there's two defenses I've heard. One is that if you've read the comic books, you don't understand how bad they're blowing this. And it's like, of course I haven't read the comic books. You know why? Because I'm 42 years old. I don't read comic books.
I'm going the other way with that. I read comic books. There's some excellent comic books out there. I haven't gotten to this series, but one of my big nerd pet peeves is people who read the book and they're like, the movie wasn't nearly as good as the book. They changed the storylines. It's like they're two completely different things, all right? Like,
yeah.
let's just not even have that conversation because I didn't read the book and I didn't read the comic books and I don't care, nerds. I sit next to a zombie nerd every single week while I watch this show. It's my wife, and I have to listen to her complain the entire show.
About zombies and, or nerds or like comic books?
Zombies. No, this is what she complains about. Well, they keep changing. Well, the thing about zombies is she talks like that. I don't know why. It's just weird. The thing about zombies is they keep changing the zombie rules. Like in the first season, they had to cover themselves in guts, and now they can just hide under cars. It's like, look, if you like poke holes in The Walking Dead, then you're really not going to enjoy it. Just suspend all disbelief and enjoy the killing of zombies.
Wait a second. I disagree with her point. They covered themselves in guts because they had to walk among the zombies to get to where they needed to go. If you're not covered in the guts, the zombies come after you.
See, now, Bill, you're falling into the wrong category here. You're also overanalyzing it and trying to, like, justify whatever the writers are doing. It's like, who cares? Like, who cares if what they're doing doesn't make any sense? None of what they do makes sense. They fished a zombie out of a well last week. So they could, what, like, save the water? Like, if a zombie was swimming around in your well, would you start drinking the water after that? No. And they used human bait. Like, it just didn't make any sense. But, like, who cares?
I said to my wife, they're lowering the guy, and I'm like, oh, well, you know why they're doing this, because something's going to break, and the guy's going to almost fall in, they're going to pull him out.
Yeah.
It's not like I stopped watching. I kept watching. I enjoyed it.
Exactly.
Oh, it broke.
Like, of course
fall
it's
in.
Stupid. Like, no, he didn't hang himself with the rope he put down there. You know what we got to do? We got to grab Glenn and put him down the well with the zombie frog. Like, come on. It makes no sense. Of course it doesn't make sense. Stop trying to have it make sense.
Yeah, it seems like the smart people on the internet, it seems like they're really desperate to have this show mean something more than it does, and it's some sort of, who knows? Like, there's more going on. Like, this is really...
Well, if those smart people email you, just give them my phone number so I can yell at them and call them nerds.
Well, but it's just like, the parallel of the end of society is that you can...
It really is the microcosm for the way our existence.
Yeah.
What is the meaning of life? It's like, no. It's zombie killing.
There's no microcosm.
All right? Let's kill some zombies.
Here's how this show is probably pitched. They're the comic book people liked. And they were like, let's make this into a show. Oh, that's cool. Let's do it. Well, let's get a showrunner. Oh, they get the guy from Shawshank. Hey, what's your vision for the show? Here's my vision. There's just some zombies and there's a group of people and they're just trying to survive. And, I'll try every 3 or 4 times per show. We'll just shoot some of the zombies in the head or we'll hit them in the heads with baseball bats to kill them.
Yeah.
And that's really all I got.
Yeah, and maybe, sir, can we have some attractive women?
Yes, we can, actually.
What about some badass male characters? Can we have that, too?
Yeah, well, you can have that. And I have a love triangle. I don't know if you've ever heard of this concept with a love triangle.
Wait, I think I've seen one in a sex shop. What's a love triangle?
Yeah. So what's going to happen is the cop is going to be – they're going to think he's dead. So his wife just immediately starts hooking up with the best friend. But then the cop comes back and it's going to be awkward. We'll get like 8 episodes out of that.
Oh, okay. I think I saw that on Homeland.
Yeah. Homeland took it. So
same thing. I can't – that's when I watched them both on Sunday night. I'm like, this is the same thing.
Same plot. But anyway, back to the point is that it's just zombies getting shot in the head and hit with axes and hit with baseball bats and they're chasing people and you can't be bit by them. And at any, the best thing they established in season 1 was that anybody can die at any point in time.
Yeah.
Which is good. Once you've taken that lid off the show and I now know that any character I'm watching can be dead, it's you're on your toes.
We should start a pool if anyone cared, but everyone's too busy hating the show to like actually care about who's going to die next.
Hey, but, I have another thing for you, Jacoby.
If you don't
like the show, don't watch it. If you don't like it.
Yeah. How about that?
Just don't watch it. Just don't watch the show. Nobody has a gun in your head.
Show.
It's free.
There's a lot of things in life that we can overthink and analyze and break down. Like, it's really good for that stuff. Zombie shows, no. I just want to see dead zombies of different shapes and sizes, and I want them to each have – and you know what else I want? I want them to, like, get a bunch of crazy weapons. Like, I feel like they don't have a good enough variety of weapons.
That's a good point.
You know, like I want slingshots and dart guns and chainsaws and axes and just like they should just go to a hard. Oh, hey, this is weird. We just fell into a hardware store. I mean, doesn't that happen in every single zombie movie?
Or somebody has like an exotic machete collection.
Yeah, exactly.
20 machetes. Oh, look at this one. It's got a double handle.
Yeah, they're walking through an abandoned house and someone, you know this thing, like when someone pulls the wrong book on the old library, on the bookshelf, and like all of a sudden it turns around and there's just a ninja arsenal there. Like, we could use that scene.
I am going to complain about one thing about The Walking Dead. This is the only thing.
You're not allowed. No, you're not allowed to complain about The Walking Dead.
But this has nothing to do with the plot or why the show exists.
If the only complaint can be not enough nudity.
Well, that's a whole other thing. I mean, if this was on HBO, the show goes to a whole another level. And also, we get naked female zombies, which would have been good, because then you're like grossed out by them, but you're secretly attracted to them. Yeah. Now, I think they just botched the lead. Rick, he's a bad actor. Not good.
Oh, you think?
Rick's not good.
Here's the thing is, like, I don't think of him as a bad actor. I think of him as like just a dude I don't like.
Like, you know,
there's something
like
about him I don't really like.
Well, I'm about to ruin it for you, and it's going to all make sense, and you're going to not like him from this point on. British.
Oh, you ruined it for me.
I did. He's a British guy. They hired a British actor, and now he's pretending he's some southern sheriff, and he's got a terrible accent. And as soon as you know he's British, you can't look at him the same way anymore.
Yeah, you
just he's the British guy who's pretending he's a southern sheriff, who then they finish the filming for the day. He's like, hello, who wants to go out for a drink?
They sound the like Newcastle Michael game on.
Yeah, they sound like Michael Davies and Roger Bennett. As soon as filming ends, he's complaining about Arsenal. Yeah, he's complaining about Arsenal.
Well, hopefully we can kill him off. That's the thing about this show. Let's just write a letter to whoever's running the show now and just say, like, hey, how about you kill him off and just get Shane back in there.
So he's one of those guys that you kind of know sometimes who's going to have a career after the show. Like, you started watching Mad Men, and you see John Hamm, and you go, John Hamm, that guy is that guy's going to go on to some stuff. Like, you can just kind of feel it. This guy, 10 years from now, you're going to see him on CSI New Orleans or whatever.
As the dead body.
Or somebody who's questioned for 5 minutes. Like, hey, that's the British guy. No, isn't he the sheriff from The Walking Dead? Yeah. But everybody else is pretty good, though, I think. Like, I think his wife is good.
Yep, she's good.
I like the other guy who shaved his head. I enjoy that guy.
Oh, I love him. That's Shane. I love that guy. I think he should take over as the lead. The end of the season, Sheriff Rick.
I'm bored. I like the blonde girl who wanted to die at the end of season one. I think she's effective. I like the old guy.
Oh, you know who I like? I like the new hot cowboy chick.
I love hot cowboy chick. Hot cowboy chick is great.
We should just keep her around.
Hot cowboy chick needs to stay. I love the black guy. I like the guy who's kind of – he was dangerous in season one, but now he's kind of the good guy who walks around with bow and arrow.
The Boondocks – Norman Reedus from the Boondock Saints?
Bow and arrow guy, I call him.
Yeah, he's Boondock Saint to me.
Yeah, the only regret I have with this show is that
you're not allowed to do this, Bill. Like enough. Like,
this is just something I wish for. I'm not bitching.
Zombies or more boobs, I'm not in.
I wish the son had just died. I didn't want to be in the hospital bed with the son for two episodes. Kill it. That's five zombies that I could have murdered.
Yeah. I think there was one dead zombie in this last week. Like, if I was running the show, I'd be like, look, unless there's seven dead zombies, don't even send me a rough cut.
Yeah, we want...
Don't even send me a rough cut. More dead zombies, please.
They need to hire Rob Nyer as a statistical consultant for zombie kill per episode. And if it ever dips below like 8.5, then they just need to force feed a couple scenes in there.
All right. Well, here, you just gave me a good idea. When you said they need to hire Rob, what was the first thing that came to my head?
Bill Barnwell?
They need to hire Rob Zombie.
Oh.
Rob
as
Zombie.
A showrunner?
Showrunner. Rob Zombie for the zombie movie. And he's like he's a nerd, so the nerds would love him. And have you ever seen his movies? His movies are fantastic.
Well, they're really grisly.
I like it. I'm in on Rob Zombie. At least have him do a cameo as a zombie. I mean, come on. A little wink wink for our comic book friends.
Well, let me tell you something, Andy Greenwald and Lane Brown and other people out there who piss on The Walking Dead because it doesn't fit their little comic book fantasy for what the show should be. I support The Walking Dead, and I'm proud to walk alongside Dave Jacoby.
I'm with that. And another thing is, like, look, man, I'm not against – see, I don't want people to think, like, oh, like, he's not a comic book. Like, I'm going to get my Comic-Con friends together and beat him up. Like, I read comic books. I love comic books. This is not a comic. You can critique comic books on your own time. This is a television show. It's on a Sunday night. After a long weekend, I just want to sit on the couch, dinner's over, and just, you know, zone out and watch some zombies get killed. I don't want to think about the meaning of life, and I don't want to care about character arcs or any of this stuff. I want to watch zombies die. So just let me watch zombies die in peace.
And the other thing is, Homeland is just awesome. I love Homeland. And here's the move. You watch Homeland.
Talking about guys that are going to have a career, Bill.
Which guy?
The Homeland guy, Brody.
Oh, Brody.
Yeah, Brody's plus putting together a wonderful, wonderful performance. I can't believe I just said that.
Plus, he's going to be Joe House's – if we ever have a fantasy basketball league, he's naming his team name this year the Brody Beat-Offs. I don't know if you knew that. Joe Mead, we're not editing that. This is a mature conversation. An hour.
Joe Mead is totally editing that. I guarantee
Joe Mead, we're keeping that. I'll take the heat. Because that was one of the top – that now we're in full spoiler alert, but top three most disturbing masturbation scene of all time.
I mean, I don't want to – we can open up that conversation door.
Let's
but I don't
do Homeland next
go,
time.
I don't think we want to go inside that conversation room, but I wasn't disturbed by it at all. I rather enjoyed it. enjoyed it. I don't know what you're talking about.
Let's do Homeland. Let's do Homeland next week because that show is awesome and it's so well done and it's really well acted except for Claire Danes' boss, who I just think is terrible. Not Mandy Patinkin, the other guy.
Who's Saul or the African American guy?
The African American boss. It's like Dennis Haysbert was in for the part, and then 10 seconds before the filming, he had to cancel because like his mom got sick, and they were just like, who looks like Dennis Haysbert?
They couldn't get Stringer from The Wire.
Bad actor. You see this sometimes with the AMC and Showtime shows. Like they spend all their money. It's almost like a small market basketball team. Like they spend their money on a couple stars, and then like the seventh and eighth men are terrible. But
that's another thing, Bill. I'm not doing that while I'm watching TV. I'm not thinking about is this a good performance or a bad performance.
No, but Homeland is something you're critically.
Like, I don't notice. I don't even notice that he's a bad actor. I don't care. I just want to see Brody, and I want to see Claire Danes, and I want to. And you saw the last one.
Yeah, I mean, so you probably loved the car scene.
Oh yeah, the car scene was good and weird.
I don't want to give away too much for our Homeland podcast, which we'll do before the season finale.
Yeah, okay.
But, Claire Danes plays the perfect lunatic female. Just awesome. She hits. You can see she even has the crazy eyes, which I didn't
know. But you have to
awesome
put brilliant.
Crazy
She's
eyes.
Like the brilliant lunatic female. Because lunatic female is just like
awesome
you know, a
character.
Homeless person walking around pushing a shopping cart. But she's like a brilliant, talented lunatic female.
Yeah. She's the talent. You're having a drink with her and you know it's not going to end well and it's going to be potentially terrible for your career and your personal life. But she's like, I'm going to get another drink. Do you want one? You're like, sure.
What do you mean by having a drink with, Bill? Is that some sort of
Brody.
Does it mean something else?
I was saying Brody yesterday. That's what made me think of that, the Brody show.
That makes sense. Let's get back to Zombieland real quick because here's some of the complaints that I hear from my lady on the couch.
Okay.
She's like, we're watching this thing, and she's like, oh, the flashbacks. Another flashback that doesn't mean anything. This is stupid. Like, these new writers are ruining it. And it's like, who cares about the flashback doesn't mean anything? All I care is that it's over, and then we get to kill some more zombies.
Yeah.
Like, my only complaints are, like, not weirder zombies. Like, I like zombie animals, like amputee zombies. I want zombies to fall out of ceilings and pop out of closets. Like, that's what I'm after. Get a nail gun. Can we get these people a nail gun?
I want a nail gun is good. More machetes. I'd like to have some naked zombies, and they could blurkle them like they do in the real world. Let's get
we can have, like a jackhammer. Like, let's just get them some new tools.
Yeah. How about a guillotine? Just, in my backyard, I've always had this guillotine. Really? Why do you have a guillotine?
This zombie just walked into a guillotine.
Yeah.
Let's booby trap some zombies. Let's light them on fire. Let's have some fun. I want fire. Zombies lit on fire, running after somebody, getting shot in the head with a crossbow. Is that so hard to have?
Everyone lay off the killing. It's a show where these people are just supposed to kill zombies every week. That's it. If you're looking for anything more than that, get a life.
Yeah,
that's our
real.
Take. Last thing, real world. Speaking of getting a life, neither of us have one. the real world. We're about halfway through the season. Give me a grade at the halfway point.
F-plus?
F-plus, interesting. F-plus. F-Frank.
Plus. And here's the thing, is like, they don't have much. And you know they don't have much because of this season on. And like, I think last week they did like the, like, you know, like the sort of midway point, like the rest of the season on montage.
Yeah.
It's like they really don't have much. There's not a siren in there. There's not a hook. There's not a single like a blurkled out shot in there. It's like you can tell they don't have a lot to go with. And I feel like it just, it gets to a point where it's sure there's bad casting, but bad casting is sort of like a fixed variable in the equation over the course of the season. At this point, it's become bad producing, you know? Like, I feel like they need to, like, drop them off in the Congo and just, like, leave them without food for a week or something. Like, they really need to do something to mix it up.
Dave Jacoby, I'm glad you brought this up because I feel the same way about this year's Real World cast as I do about the Patriots defense.
Okay.
Bad drafting. And you can patch it together all you want and call your blitzes and put six defensive backs out there and take all these different chances. But ultimately, if you don't have the talent, you're going to lose games. And that's
they're
where
not
we
even
are
putting together good blitz packages for them, though.
First of all, how you have a 19-year-old, how you have your token airhead with the implants, but isn't old enough to get in any bars, is just a bad draft pick. It's like Belichick
it
taking 2 second-round running backs.
Sense. It just
can't
doesn't
do
make
it.
Sense.
Can't.
It's
do
like
it.
No. And it's then, like it's like drafting a one-legged running back.
Right, and then they failed another test, Jacobs. If you look at the history of what works for a real world season, we need at least one guy on the show that people like you and I could look at. Well, I'm too old now, but you know, just be like, I could have hung out with that guy. That guy could have hung with my boys. I could have gone out with that guy one night and it would have been a good time. They don't have that guy this year.
Not even that. They don't even have anything remotely close to that.
No. They did such a bad job. I'm fine with the Frank. I'm even fine with Zach or Nate, but you can't have Zach and Nate and then Frank and then no fourth guy.
And then the other thing is, like, even the girls, like, usually there's a girl who's walking, like, oh, you know, like she could hang out one night. Like, the closest thing to, like, a person I'd like to have a beer with on that cast is Eminem Sam. Like,
yeah,
she seems
Eminem
to be, like,
Sam.
The closest thing to someone I could have a good conversation with for a half an hour and then go out.
I like Eminem Sam. I like her.
Like she seems to have like the best attitude and sort of like understanding of how to have a good time and not be a weirdo.
Oh, speaking of bad casting, we were talking about this lousy Survivor season yesterday watching football, and I threw out my idea of the all-female Survivor season, which you just got. You almost had to take a lap. You were so excited.
Sometimes when you have these ideas, and they don't happen that often, it kind of like pisses me off. They're so good.
That you didn't come
up with
them?
You know what I mean? Because I didn't come up with them.
Yeah.
Like, it would have been great.
Survivor.
And my only take is that they would have, like, I think the only reason that Mark Burnett hasn't enacted this is because there's going to be some sort of statutory rape claim against the women on the part of the production staff.
Oh, because it's just all them with all the women the whole time?
It's just all estrogen all the time. And there's, like, some, like, you know, burly cameraman who, like, lives in Denver
just
and, like,
handle
hikes
it.
For
yeah.
a living. And he's got a beard. He's got, like, an awesome gravelly voice. And, like, and they just eventually they just attack him and then disrobe him and just have their way with him. And he would probably
put up a
case against Mark Burnett.
So if we had the all-female Survivor, first of all, that solves the issue of you reach that tipping point where there are no really good-looking girls left that people like us, where that's one of the reasons we're watching is because we're always rooting for the one really attractive female to just last as long as possible.
I mean, it's not like the only reason. It's just a nice garnish to the plate to always have some eye candy around.
It's like Gonzaga in the NCAAs. You're rooting for it. You know it's
not
probably
why we're
end
here,
of the final
but it's
16.
Nice to have.
Yeah, it's a Cinderella story because the other females were always turned on this person and vote them off, unless it's Parvati who just was able to transcend everybody, every generation. That was their other big mistake is instead of Ozzy Coach, I would have done Parvati and Amber, I think was the no-brainer if you're going to have captains. Bring
well,
back
that's
Parvati.
Hopefully they're saving that for the all-female season.
Ooh, the all-female season with Parvati and Amber as the captains would be pretty good. Or Stephanie or whoever, but Parvati has to be involved. And then,
or they go all-female and they throw in like Russell and Boston Rob again.
No. We want all-females. And I'll tell you another thing. Don't think Jeff Probst is going to be able to keep his hands off the cast. He already dated a survivor, somebody from one of those seasons.
Is that a fact? Is that a
fact? Oh, yeah. He had a survivor girlfriend.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah.
Oh, Where have you been, son? If I gave a crap, I would Google that right now. No, yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Oh, oh yeah.
Good work, he'll be out, like,
he'll be hosting those tribal counselors, like wearing like a smoking jacket and a pipe, hey, ladies.
And no pants.
Time for another tribal council in my pants. Anyway, Dave Jacoby, the only other living Walking Dead defender on the earth. Thanks for coming on. We will check out your bad QBL column on Tuesday, and then your reality scorecard, which has really revolutionized reality TV writing as we knew it, which we didn't really know it because nobody really
no one did it before.
But, yeah, you've seized some land that didn't really exist. And we couldn't be prouder of you.
Hey, it's my corner.
Talk to you soon.
All right.
Target the sun off. Whoa!
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.